Hey, everybody, it's Greg McVicar, creator of Undercurrents. Glad you're listening. This is KBOO 90.7, Portland.
KBOO Community Radio just wrapped up our annual fall membership drive. Support from listeners like you helped us reach our goal, gain new members, and prepared us to bring you more organic, homegrown, fresh-off-the-vine community radio. Thanks to all those who donated during this drive, and thanks to those who listened in. Stay tuned for more.
KBOO.
We're doing that now. Episode begin.
You're listening to the Tin Can Phone Podcast on KBOO Portland.
You are listening to Tin Can Phone on KBOO Portland.
You're listening to the Tin Can Phone Podcast.
3 years in, preseason in, I ain't talking that time. We was stuck in the pen, all the work they kept, all the work put in. Got it out the much, see the dirt in our hands. Pretty boy Poots had a dope ass plan. The recorder came in when Mike came in, so 10 can phone with contraband. Now you not, but still convicted. Damn, they did our brother wrong. 12 on the yard and he walked that off. Now Jaja's when he walk it out. KB packed like my cousin house, but we ain't throwing hands, we talking it out. Bring your own blanket, we at grandma's house. It's Mike, it's Joe, it's Poots, it's me. We was out there yelling, free BG. It's Mike, it's Blue, it's Misfit Queens. Buddy in the cut, that's perfect scene. 10 can phone, that's something to see. I didn't do it, so I preach to the street, still praising the hood. Like I didn't lose Queef, Moon, Ben, and Billy too. When it comes to this life shit, but I'm cool. So every picture I'm throwing up too.
Tin Can Phone, Misfit Audi, Season 3. What's happening? We got the gang in this muff. Ooh, photo shoot fresh, huh? Blue, what is happening?
What's up, homie? So good to see you. I know the listeners don't get to see the duds you're sporting, but that Trauma Almost One gear is on point. I love seeing that. Your own business. I can't wait to hear more about it. It's good to be here with everybody. Good to see you guys. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing really well. I'm fresh transplant from the best coast to Baltimore, Maryland, and I'm finally all set up here and am over like the move. You know, the last time we saw each other and spoke, it was very chaotic. I was kind of living out of my like suitcase floating around in hometown. And it was fun to get to see a whole bunch of people and say goodbye and send off, but it also like really delayed the move. So, you know, as fun as that all was, it feels nice to have closed that chapter and be on to something that feels completely fresh and in a new environment that I could speak at length about maybe later down the line. But I find Baltimore really homey and refreshing space, so that's felt really inspiring in a lot of ways.
Well, buddy, it's good to have you in the studio, so to speak. For listeners, this is the guy who got a small intro on our last episode but has been producing the show on the back end and is joining us today on what is in ways sorrowful, though it's good to hear that folks are good, all things considered. And is also interesting temporally. We're recording right before air, so this is pretty fresh and contemporary if you're hearing it on Tuesday on KBOO. That being said, in the time paradox of our string of episodes, last you heard us, we were with our friend, peer, collaborator, Armand, who both founded kind of this project in different forms, Great American Stories, which has come up in general, and we kind of aired the first of that, you know, last episode. And yeah, the sad news is that Armand passed away in, I guess, what was it, early September at this point. And I guess if we aired early October, that show aired maybe 1 or 2 days after the memorial service, which was tough. Boo and I were able to make attendance. Queez and Buddy are not geographically in this area, and it was all pretty quick. So this episode is dedicated to Armand as much as really the legacy of this project, past, present, and future. And today we're going to do a little bit of honoring Armand and his name, as well as kind of looking more deeply into a challenging context that I guess has come up on the show, but as we've referenced other legacy members of the team, Ben Hall, addiction is a character, I guess, in this work that continues to challenge this project, but I guess as I sit with the way that this project evolves, it really actually is a major character in the way that incarceration absolutely does not address the issue, and then the way that post-carceral life spins out into maybe unproductive aspects as well as loss of life. So that's what we're here to do today. And maybe, folks, we'll cycle through and I can go last just to reflect on, you know, the loss of Armand. And maybe, I mean, Quees in so many ways. I don't know. I mean, our closest. I mean, you and him were companions on the inside. Curious. Paul. Yeah. The furthest back in knowledge.
Nah. Yeah. Man, I'm not even going back. Like, yeah, that went hit hard, though, because, like, even on the inside, we wasn't just hella dumb. That's cool, right? But we was on the same unit, you feel me? And then passing, it was always like, what's happening? Because I seen him politic and I seen him always talking, you feel what I'm saying? He was always talking to the people. And if you know Quees, then you know I politic. I'm to the people. I'm with the people. So we ended up, you feel me? And then, like, that was literally, like, a couple months before Great American Stories was created, you feel what I'm saying? Like, so him, me seeing that in him, Middle Eastern, he, you feel me? He didn't have no, you feel me? Bro was just different. A jokester, you feel me? Bro was really like a jokester, but bro was really different. So then I get the little wop, like, hey, we doing the Great American Story. Well, it wouldn't even call Great American Stories yet, but we doing the thing. He bringing the recorder in, wop, wop, wop. He want to interview you. I'm like, oh, yeah, good, you feel me? So then I ain't going to lie to y'all. The Great American Stories, after that interview, is when Armand became a friend. Before, I just seen him on the unit, you feel me? And we just was popping it. But after the interview, we became friends. You feel what I'm saying? I don't use friend lightly. So, like, we on the yard popping it. You feel me? He got his people, he fucked with, I got mine. But we always found a way to stay connected, stay together. And then coming home, like I said, just like, I don't know, bro. He just, his energy, like, bro had a whole bunch of fucked up shit going on. You feel what I'm saying? But he still just, even through, if you go back to 10 Can Phone, man, and you listen to, my boy was in the motherfucking rehab. You feel what I'm saying? My boy was in rehab. He recorded episodes from rehab. You get what I'm saying? But, like, he still presented that. He still was laughing jokes all the way through. You feel what I'm saying? And, like, oh, no, bro. This shit still just be like, damn. I think, for me, seeing so many people fall off so early, it didn't take long when I say our graduating class came home. You feel what I'm saying? A lot of people was back to back to back to back to back to back to back. And we've seen a lot of our peers just, like, it came to the point where I took Facebook off my phone. You feel what I'm saying? I took Facebook off my phone because every time I would open up Facebook, another homie was dying. And it was like, damn, like, okay, we made it however many years it's been. I think it's been like 3 or 4 years for me, a little bit longer for bruh. And we made it this far. I think I put us in a position, that's all of us, the recently incarcerated. You feel what I'm saying? When we make it to a certain, like, many years out, I think the outside person puts he made it on you, because the repeat offenders go back within, they say 5 years, but in real life, that should be like 2-3 years. Like, they ain't making it out 2-3 years type shit. So when you make it out so long, I'm like, oh, bro, good. Even, and then this is the thing too. This is the thing with Michael, bro. A lot of the shit Armand had going on, like, Michael really was up front in person, handling parole, handling PVs, handling, you feel what I'm saying? Like, really in the mix type shit. I never really, I'm like, bro, really, like, talking to the PO and, like, really in the mix. So salute to Michael, bro. Like, I always try to give you your flowers and you act like it's easy what you do. But, like, this shit is, we really tied. Like, we have to relive our worst experiences together with 10 Can Phone. You get what I'm saying? Like, bro, addiction is heavy, and I really want to let everybody else talk, and I want to go deeper on addiction, bro, because, like, we really lost a lot of good people, and Armand was really my brother. Like, I knew he was struggling, but, like, because he made it so far out, I just, he'll be all right. He gonna be all right. He gonna be all right. Like, I put that he gonna be all right on him. You feel what I'm saying? And we never know when people is gonna be okay. If we see the signs that our homies and our friends and our people ain't okay, bro, we got to take action. We can't be joking and laughing and thinking that, you know, everything is a game. And, like, for me, that's what I fell upon. I used to talk to him and he'd just be, I know he drunk or I know he on WAP. And I'm just like, y'all know how I talk to the homies and shit. But it made him happy in that time, but it didn't do nothing towards helping him with his addiction or even giving him great advice on trying to stop or quit. You feel me? I just lightened the moment that we spent on the phone together. And I feel a little bad because I'm like, damn, I'm somebody that he corresponded with, that he actually opened up to, and that he actually listened to my advice. And instead of giving him real advice, you feel me, I just try to joke it off with the jokes that we shot at each other. And just, I think I put a blind eye to the seriousness of the addiction in order to see his smile, in order to hear his laugh, knowing what he was going through, you feel me? But I'm gonna leave it at that. I love brother, because like in the darkest place, we found humor. We found like Tin Can Phone. Like, this is what came out of building these relationships. You feel what I'm saying? Armand specifically, Joe and me, at the end of the day, like, that's three totally different motherfuckers from three totally different walks. How was that? That wasn't supposed to work. That was not supposed to work. Tin Can Phone was contraband from the beginning. It wasn't supposed to work. So we forever tied in. That's creating a family. That's creating something. And now look at us. We have a family still that's carrying this shit on. So rest in peace to my brother, bro. Like, rest in peace to my man. You feel what I'm saying? And like I always say in every post, I'm going to carry this shit on. Like, it ain't no stopping. It ain't no ending. But I'm going to leave it at that.
You bring up some really interesting points, and I want to say, because even this group has had limited opportunity to reflect on this as a group. I mean, I was at the service, and there was certainly a lot of people in Armand's life who were holding his experience. And so I want to absolve any sort of feeling of guilt that you weren't, you know, doing enough. And I think it's also important that, you know, you weren't enabling him in any way. So that's important, because that's happens. And that has come up on the show about friends dealing to friends. So, you know, all that stuff is there. And so, yeah, I wanted to chime in to say that, like, there's moments, and I'll get into it more later, where, like, I wonder about, even for myself, if there's more to have been done. And my kind of read on the family's position is that, you know, in a way, and maybe it has something to do with acceptance, it was kind of like his time, you know, just like Armand's life, as you contextualize, was going well. He had employment, he had housing, he was making plans for the future. I think maybe different from other folks we know. It's not even clear what happened. And it's also not, I'm not assuming that it was like a choice.
It was the pen, Mike. The pen, the one thing he always said was he was ashamed to his family's legacy because he did time in prison. He always tried to never allow that to be attached to him. And in a sense, like, he always tried to like act like it never happened type shit. But that's from out of his own mouth. He always repeatedly was just like, man, I'd be ashamed. Like, they'd be ashamed of me. Shame, shame. That's why he tried so hard. And you said the words, accepted. He tried so hard to be accepted in every circle because he felt shame. Not to cut you off. I knew.
No, I think that's an important, I mean, that's also why Armand was not always a consistent part of the show. And it's even only now that this part of that story is getting included. You know, I have, I met Armand's grandmother at the service, and part of her perspective was, you know, a need for this loss to mean something. So Laverne is Armand's grandmother. Shout out to Laverne. I'm going to let you know this is airing, so hopefully you'll check it out.
Shout out to Laverne.
You know, hopefully we'll be able to work with her, and Buddy and I are working with Sarah, the mother of Derek Clark. I think that this project will evolve. It has been evolving, but I think this loss is certainly a concrete sign for us that I and in service to this project want to work harder to engage the issues that people are facing. So more on all this later. Blue, I know you were at the service. Thanks for making it out. I know, like, you're a busy business guy too. And on very short notice. In fact, Blue and I were scheduled to work on some stuff that morning, and I kind of both let Blue know in the process of canceling our plans to make the trip out to Armand's service. But yeah, Blue, how's all this sitting with you right now?
Yeah, man. Like, to know Armand was to like Armand. Not that he was a perfect guy, but he was good energy and a good human. And I think when I think about it, it's hard not to have it in the context of all the people we know and all the people we lose. And, you know, even the week that our mom passed, I knew other people, two other people who died that week. One guy was through a friend who had done, you know, over 20 years in prison. And another one was a friend's nephew, a graphic designer that I know. And it's like, I wonder if at this point everybody's had been touched by this. Like, but part of me thinks no, still, even though this is a epidemic in our society. Like, you know, when we create tight bonds, and I think maybe one of the guys at Queez kicking it with our mom on the unit, and one of my best friends on the inside, you know, is gone as well. And just so many people that do not make it for different reasons. But I think that how insidious these drugs are, and trying to understand even this like fentanyl issue, it's like, they're making money off this? Like, they're making money off it? How? Like, what? Where does this come from? Like, how do you unpack this if it's not? And I'm not trying to be a conspiracy theorist, but I'm just going to put it out there because we're on the radio. But what the hell? I've heard that people are buying that stuff for 80 cents. Like, how do you make money off 80 cents when you can have the person come to you once?
Yeah.
Like, what the hell is that all about? Like, and I'm not talking about war on drugs, but something.
It's an agenda, Mob. It's an agenda. You got to understand, you know, with the drug world, once somebody die, everybody want it. All they need is one. You feel me? Like, it's, don't be...
Say more about that. They, I mean,
tripping.
That's...
They tripping. Like, it's crazy, bro. We've seen this already, though. You feel me? History repeats itself. You get what I'm saying? They making it chalk. They throwing it in school yards. You feel what I'm saying? They making it... Like, you got to think, just like in stores, the shit you want the kids to be attracted to, you put up front and you put colors on it. They touching the youth because it's already over with for us. And now we're speaking in society and the puppet masters, we're speaking from their vision. Our generation and what's going on in the world right now, we're damn near lightweight living in, like, we're living in a lawless land in a sense. You feel what I'm, like, you get what I'm saying? We're starting to go into a lawless land. You feel what I'm saying? And like Freeway, Rick Ross, all, you know, the government been producing and giving and handing out the work. You feel what I'm saying? It ain't no secret that all these different strands and all these different drugs that's coming out and looking the same and all these different colors, they not doing that up the street in the trailer. You feel me? They making shake and bake up there. So when all these, you got to think how much this, and then you always see, oh, a bust on 10 pounds and this and that and that and the Georgia man. And come on, bro. Y'all, they making this shit, and that's their way to introduce it to us. You feel me? They put it in TV. They put it in our face, shove it in our face, normalize it. You get what I'm saying? But then they also knocking motherfuckers off. You got to think about this. Every organization that had a great leader, every organization that had multiple great leaders, they was divided by what? Drugs, money, power. You feel what I'm saying? And it all came from the government. This shit been happening. You get what I'm saying? Like, I ain't no theory person either. I don't look at theory. I look at facts. I don't argue feelings. I don't argue theories. I argue straight facts. And we've seen this shit already. You get what I'm saying?
They, I think well, the whole time with that, though, I think Queez, it's hard for people to like think about, like, is there something deeper going on? Because
they better open up their mind. Then
we don't want to
think thoughts for small minds. Read a book.
But when sometimes people even say, like, we talk about the prison industrial complex being like about money, like, it's hard to like get those steps to where you can like understand how commerce is involved in like these, you know, this mass incarceration. And I think sometimes I see people just glaze over when you start to talk about something like that, the prison industrial complex. And it's like, it is there. Just too much because there's too many steps before
the thing, Blue.
This is real.
You gotta care enough.
Has to be something.
Bro, all you gotta do is care enough. Because you're gonna, whatever you care enough about, you're gonna go look it up. You're gonna go research. It's not hard. It's not hard. You feel what I'm saying? You just gotta care enough. Motherfuckers don't care enough about. My coworker the other day just literally said, I feel like every sex offender should just die. I'm like, damn, even the ones that was wrongly convicted? Even the ones that was in college playing football ended up, blah, blah. Like, it's so many different, because I've been in prison, and I'm like, so just anybody who, like, you feel me? You look up the internet, whatever the internet says, whatever the system says about you, that's why we brought humanization back to being in prison. You feel me? That's what all these programs was about. The Lib, the tin can phones, arson social practice. That's what this was about. Humanized. That's why the police hated it. That's why tin can phone really had to be shaped, and that's why we have our bondage now. That's exactly why our shit is in bondage now. You feel what I'm saying? I don't know, bro. It's not hard though, because you care enough about it, you gonna look it up, bro. You feel what I'm saying? You had to look up non-unanimous jury when they asked, convicted you on a non-unanimous jury. You probably didn't care about that before. But then when you start seeing that, oh, hold on, this is a real life thing. Dove into those law books. If you care enough about it, Mike, when we was inside interviewing professors and all the students and all these different things we was doing, bruh, people didn't even know it was a prison right there in Portland. You guys are in college, law, social justice, all these different things, and you don't even know that it's a prison right here in Portland? People don't care enough about it. People rather just, it is what it is, and we love the law because rehabilitation, inmate has a bad name on it. Ex-con has a bad name on it. So the average American, he going to hear, I don't even want to look up prison. I don't even want to look at prison. Yeah. I don't even want to have nothing to do with that, because even if I find out the truth, am I going to have the guts to stand up to the system? So a lot of people don't even want to let's just leave it there. Our grandparents said this, our parents said this, that's just what we're going to believe. That's where unlearning comes from, so that you can relearn, so that you can educate yourself. But that's the part everybody's skipping over, because I'm going to just see what's on Instagram or Facebook, and I'm going to believe what the fuck I see there. You get what I'm saying? It's easier. Who wants to unlearn? Who wants to say, damn, I was wrong because I believed this my whole life? That means my granny, my daddy, my uncle, and my mama was wrong because they taught me this. Who wants to go through those steps? Healing is a... Bruh, trauma almost won. The saying is, healing is a hard process. Look good doing it. I got to call people on their shit because, mama, you was wrong. You feel me? And that's what 10 Can Phone is about. We bring the humanization. We bring the information. They depend on us to tell the truth.
There's something interesting about... Well, there's a lot of things that are interesting about what you're saying, but, I think education is not enough. I mean, I was in prison, visiting mm-hmm. with folks who were interested, but I don't know that it remains a part of their life. I think the way that it comes up, I was in a meeting and it was with a bunch of artists and other concerned citizens. And I was telling them, I said, if the work that you're doing isn't about abolition, it's not for me. Like, it can still be good work. Like, people go in and they run programs that are good. But, Armand, Ben, Ben racked up some programs, right? So I think that there's a way in which people, you can know about it and you can not know how to make, and I don't know that I can make a difference, right? Like, I believe that I want to orient towards that. But I think my personal relationship to it, I think this has come up on the show, or even I think my mom mentioned it when she was talking to you. My grandmother had over 300 foster children in her home. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of stuff, it's generational, right? Like, I'm in this, that's how I found myself wanting to go to the prison. Okay. I mean, and even I wouldn't even have associated those thoughts until later, but I was ready to do some deeper unpacking about what it means. I think a lot of people are exposed and they can do the research, and then to take action is a totally different story. And that's, again, separate, when someone doesn't even know to look. And so it's deep, the way in which there's deniability. And I mean, I think something that is hopefully, or I will crystallize it in this comment, that this episode serves to say that you can be aware and you can be around and you can be involved. And it's not until there's real loss. Even society, we can graduate it out to everything that happened in the COVID George Floyd era. And with a bunch of terrible stuff happening, we got new programs, we got new legislation, we got, sports teams' names changes. And now, today, it feels like things are almost back to normal in comparison. And I continue to say to folks that it's going to get worse before it gets better, because people aren't really ready to engage until it's really on their doorstep or beyond. So anyway, buddy, I want to give you a chance to dig in a little too.
It's an exceptionally tough point to reflect from, because to contextualize as far back as it goes in terms of my involvement, at no point have I ever envisioned or really desired, to be a voice on this show. I've never really felt like that's where my role was or where I could offer something to the project. And Armand is the reason for you know, my introduction to the producer role. We talked a little bit about this in our most recent recording, which, just for listeners, this is our third episode in season three, and episode one and two were split into two parts, and both of which were recorded at KBOO about a month before his passing, right before I left Oregon, which felt, I'll talk a little bit more about this in a second, but it felt like such a high point in so many ways. But to just reel back, like, you know, 2019, I met Armon through a Facebook group, specifically like Producers in Portland Facebook group, right before pandemic. I was freelancing and he just posted something. He's like, I'm going to do this series on Portland food carts and I'm looking for a shooter. And, you know, I responded and we saw that we were mutual connections through OSU. And that's really, that was the level in which I got to know him on. I think we quickly recognized one another as people with a lot of drive and energy. And it became immediately obvious to me that he was an infectious personality and a hustler, an absolute hustler, and, you know, someone with just so much drive. And so that was the level in which I got introduced to this whole thing. And then it was, again, you know, through him, through that, I got to meet Mike. And after that, heard about this archive of material that Armon had mentioned a little bit in passing, like, this is a thing that I did in a past life, which is also another very interesting thing that I think we could talk about at length, is, you know, it was like an onion. Hanging out and being around Armon was kind of like an onion. You see different layers and then he'll drop a little bit of information, then you kind of peel back and it raises a question like, okay, what do you really mean right there? Or what is that? What are you speaking to? But you won't get the full context until you get to know him more and more and more. And it was through those peeling back of layers that I got to meet y'all. Queasy were next up, you know, at Grandma's Kitchen, which was put on by Mike. And then after the world kind of shut down, that's when, you know, Blue came into the project. And it took a long time before we even got to meet in person. You know, I got to know you through Zoom and hearing your story. And so that's now three, almost 4 years of understanding that all kind of culminated in, for me at least, in so, so many ways, because Armon, as we've mentioned, was a little bit far away from the project in the last year and a half, 2 years. Coming together in Portland and recording at KBOO, it felt so natural and appropriate to talk through all of that. You know, it was a like climactic moment, I think, for the project. So that's where my mind has been in the context of this. And after receiving the news, it was just, yeah, it was especially devastating. And, you know, I think in this moment, I would definitely agree with what Mike said. You know, this is his living legacy, kind of. He always believed in this project on the inside. He believed in it on the out, and he believed in it when he was far away from it. So, yeah, where my mind sits right now, you know, speaking on air now as someone who is not just, you know, an editor, or who initially came in as someone who was far away from you all, but now has a very close relationship and has spent a lot more time understanding the issue and have now been affected by it on a way more personal level, knowing someone that is now no longer with us. I think Mike at one point said to me something to the degree of, once you are aware of something, it is your responsibility to then take action. That is a general sort of paraphrase. And of course, we're talking about the prison industrial complex and abolition and all these things that we address topically throughout the show. But that continues to be something that reverberates in my mind and is now very closely associated with Armon and his living legacy. And I hope that as we continue to do this work, that when people listen to Tin Can Phone, they will think of him too, whether they knew him or not. This is actually like, this is a way that I kind of think and build the picture of Ben Hall in my mind, because I didn't know him personally. I hope that Armon is kind of a spoken, unspoken voice for them as they continue to listen to the show and we continue to do this work.
Yeah, there's some really, I mean, this is what happens, I guess, on the show, but I was thinking about how, I mean, I feel like people attribute the project to me somehow. I've been around for it all, but I'm more of a witness an organizer than I am what the show is about. But I was thinking about, like, you know, this was so Armand's idea that if I met Queez, I might be like working on like a clothing line and a record label, you know, like I literally really kind of opened for the people that I was talking to. I mean, sure, I was interested and I had certain talents that made it conducive, but it was Armand's idea. And the only reason he's not more central is, I think there's several different reasons, but namely what Queez brought up earlier is that he truly didn't want to be associated with this out of fear for, you know, it's interesting, the family part was certainly there, but it was more, that was even more subdued. It was the way he would describe it is that he didn't want the internet to know who that part of him, along with the professional person he was trying to become. And so it was for particularly that reason that he, even though we said, well, we got an editor, like we can edit you out, edit your name out and stuff, he would still open up every show with all of his social media handles. That continued to be a bit of a paradox to me, but, you know, I think, and he was torn, you know, like he cared for the project. He always made reappearances. He was always open to that. He just didn't want to be the person who was leading it. And so I took that role. But again, it was really his idea. And he brought so much to the show, which was like one of the reasons for bringing Blue in, was that like with him and Joe leaving, it there was big shoes to fill. And I think that the show itself is robust and worthy of being his legacy and continuing to build it. But yeah, it's really, I mean, so it's funny in a way, or terrible, but this receipt, I had to do some arm twisting, and it's funny, look here, it even says customer Armand Queez.
Oh, the suit.
So I'm holding up for the listeners a receipt that in my general accounting, and for whatever, I think we didn't even need the receipt, or we got a picture of it and that was enough or something.
We needed it because I was, you feel me? I was way out here, so I had to get a whole different suit from a whole different spot because you was going to drive all the way out here to get it. And then I'm like, nah, I'm going to get it on my way, right? That's why we needed a picture of the receipt. I don't think, I've never seen a physical receipt. I've only had the picture so I could show them, hey, is this suit type shit?
This is the physical. I think I finally got it from Armand. This was, you know, Tin Can Phone, the project, got funds that I chose to allocate to get you, Queez, and Armand suits for the Grandmother's Kitchen project. And I was like, look, now you got suits. Of course, he went with burgundy and you went with blaze red.
Come on.
They're not the most practical suits, but they are yours.
I ain't never put no suit on. You like, what color you want? I'm like, what color can I choose for?
Yeah. Like, I mean, that was the point, right?
I'm like, give me the red.
So, you know, the project was able to create that. And honestly, I was like, I'm glad he wasn't buried in it, I guess. I don't know.
I literally thought
I might roll up and that would be the case. But yeah, I mean, the project itself has done really amazing things, I think, yet to even be fully realized by the public.
Yeah.
You know, the things we've done are waiting to be more fully realized.
Yeah.
And that was all Armand in his participation or not. And for quite some time, he was directly participating. But as Buddy contextualized, like the reason, you know, we're all in this room together again was Armand. And yeah, I mean, just, I guess for the record, you know, I spoke to him several days before his passing. He called me at like midnight before I was getting ready to travel. So I talked to him for like 30 or 40 minutes and I was like, all right, man, I gotta transition, but like reach out back to me because, you know, we were talking about he's getting ready to move out of the country and was dealing with stuff and life stuff, and I could tell he was under the influence, but I also, of that telling, it was seemed cogent. You know, he really had been developing in his cogency over the years, and so I felt a little bit secure in that, but I was like, look, man, reach out to me soon. Like, you know, this challenge you're working through needs more time. And I didn't hear from him, and I called him, and I called him, and I called him for a month, and it always went straight to voicemail. And I kind of was, I had suspected that this is what happened. I was hoping for the best, but, and was interesting too, because I had less, I think, connection to the rest of his life, you know. I think whether it's a slight gap in age or whatever, I think Buddy and Queez, you got a little bit more close to his other worlds. And so I had asked this group if whatever kind of Facebook networking or whatever could kind of suss out more truth. And it was Buddy who had the connection to his coworker. We got to learn what happened. And it is incredibly fortunate timing, because within 2 to 3 days was the service. And so I'm further glad in a way. I mean, it was, you know, we're all busy guys, so no one wants to stop our hustles for especially something like this. But it felt really important to go. Yeah.
Just wanted to bring in, yeah, that was a, I didn't know you were going to bring up the memorial. That was really hard to see. It's something unnatural that I'm sure most people have experienced at some point in their life, to see a young man, you know, laying there gone, you know. And of course, I have my own beliefs that, you know, that's not him, but it's still profoundly disturbing and powerful space to just be in. I just think it's interesting, like, to hear, like, Buddy's story in with Armand, and to know that also, like, having been connected with us and through that experience, like, we have become, like, central in Buddy's life. Like, maybe that's an overstatement, but the fact that you're, like, your film that you put together for graduation, I mean, how do you get there without that connection? How do you get there without meeting Armand? And what, how different does that look? And who's telling Takuma's story, or who's telling the story of non-unanimous juries? And it's just like, to think of those ripples and connections through something so, like, by chance, you know, like everything here. And I think, I mean, it could be seen similarly. I mean, I only spent my last 6 months at CRCI, and it's in that time that I met Michael, you know. And and I think one thing I'd like for us to check in about, I don't want to, like, take us away from anything that people want to talk about specifically with Armand, but is this, like, he's an amazing human, Armand, right? Like, he was an amazing person. Like, he impacted people that he came into contact with. And there's some guys that we've known, and Queez has spoken on this before, but they're at their best on the inside, right? And I just was thinking about, like, we've gotten to sometimes experience the magic of who somebody really is. And it's so messed up, because it was because they were locked up. And it's like, it's not, locking up is not the answer, but it's like, I just, like, feel for these people's families. Like, I mean, Mike and I have friends that have died, and but we have other friends that just, the drugs are insidious and turn them into people you don't want to be around, turn them into people who aren't safe or aren't kind or can't handle life. And yet I've seen guys like that on the inside that were just so brilliant and wrote songs and played the guitar and shared music and shared ideas and thoughts and created, and then struggle, pain, harshness, hopelessness, you know, on the outside. It's such a big shift from who the people are that we know.
You know what it'd be, though, and this is up Great American Stories. You feel what I'm saying? What I mean by that is, people create these personas inside. They don't present their true self, you know, because of the toxic masculinity and, you know, all the different things that's in prison, the history, the wise tales of prison. People go in with this certain, you know, you got to be the baddest motherfucker, feel me, type situation. And you never really would get to see the true people who they are. And then even if somebody kind of accidentally do something in a crime, in a sense, you might have closed your eyes and shot somebody on accident. But once you get in prison, you carry it as if, hey man, I did that. Like, I you feel me? And it's like, you ain't got to really do that, bro. You really was scared, you feel me? And you was protecting yourself, my boy. Like, you not really one of them like that. But what I say that is to say people create these personas inside to get through prison. And you can go back to Tin Can Phone first season and hear all type of different stories about the characters inside. Like, you meet these characters inside. And then when they come home, they forget to leave that persona in prison as a reputation. They take that home and they tell the story so much, and they twist their stories that they did on the streets. You know, the Great American Stories, like I said, so much that they begin to believe it, though. And then once you begin to believe that, that's your reality. When you come home and you're not that person that you really, like, begin to believe you was when you came home, you know what that causes? That causes depression. Because now you built this thing around yourself as if you was really this, and you not that when you get home. You burnt your family. You stole from them. You burnt your friends. You burnt a bunch of bridges when you went in. Those bridges are still burnt when you come home. So you're not coming home to support. And this ain't all cases. I'm not saying this is all cases, but this is most cases in personal situations and people that I know. They, you know, those personas. So then that causes depression. Depression usually leads to drugs. Drugs lead, you feel what I'm saying? It's a cycle. It's a whole cycle, and we see it. And usually the only thing that saves most guys is going back to prison.
Right, but crazy. Who's the real guy, though? Like, that's the question, right? Is the real guy the guy on the outside, or the real guy the guy on the inside? Because I met people that are extraordinary in there who are dynamic and beautiful and amazing. And I mean, even, or brilliant artists or kind. And then the drugs, I have to say, I think the drug is the thing that.
But you see, the drug, it's the reason
who they are.
It ain't like they're just different people. It's the drugs. And that's what I was leading. It's the drugs, bro. But then you do, when your wires get twisted in your head, we make jokes about our laugh. Are we sensitive? We're insensitive to those sayings, but people with them drugs fry brain cells. You get what I'm saying? When you start frying brain cells and you start, bruh, that shit is really doing something to your being. But we just could see, like, oh, it's drugs. So we just leave it at that. Oh, it's just drugs. He burnt out. Person is really, so then you get off of drugs when you go to jail. You see them dudes work out, they get stupid buff and shit. They be hella big in there. But it's like, if you come home, you're gonna lose it type shit. It's hard to say who the real person is, and only time would tell, bruh. Only time. That's like doing years with people, then you get to see who people are, because you can't keep that shield for years. But doing a couple months, 18 months, you don't know if this, especially if they come in with 18 months. That ain't even enough time to really even see who you are yourself. Yeah. You get what I'm saying?
So it's recover hard to say, from that trauma of it going in.
This is one thing I say. I be all the way real with people, because then I mean, I can't say I expect you, but usually if I could give you the real me, you wouldn't have no problem giving me the real you. So with every person I encounter, I just got to give you the real me. And, you know, hopefully you give me the real you. Because I can, you know, that's what happened with friendships. I want this, and that, but you're not giving that. You feel me? You don't even know how to receive that, because you never had somebody give you that in a friendship. You get what I'm saying? That's why Michael's so important. He keep acting like he don't know why he's so important, because all of us, yeah, you said the show was about us, but we've all experienced these times that if the show was really on our back, this shit would have failed already. It's already done been times for every single host and co-host that if the show was 100% on us, that we was the ones like that, it would have failed already. But the one consistent thing is Michael come through and clean up. Come on, let's get this shit back on the road. Come on, hey, what we doing? Where we at? You feel what I'm saying? That's the importance. We could show up and be the talent. We could show up and be the ones that was recently incarcerated. But if we all had to carry the show and the show was on us to make sure we made it through a season, a two episodes, shit would have went under already. That's why you so important. That's why we be like, not really because of Mike, though, because when we was down, every person could have came home. The only thing that kept motherfuckers straight, 10 Can Phone. You feel me? Because we know we prepping for this. We got shit to do. We gotta interview motherfuckers. So when we came home, we all promised each other, bro, we going to get this shit popping. But you had to hold it together for us to even make it home.
Go ahead. I mean, it brings up some interesting layers. There's more than I can remember to talk about, but one of the things I'm thinking about is what Blue was saying with people are kind of their best inside in a way. This is so complicated. I think drugs is a thing, but so is the stresses of life. And when you're out in the wild and you gotta like make rent and all this stuff. I mean, Blue and I are working with a guy right now who's in dire straits, and it's not a scenario that cultivates your best self. When you're inside and you're without all of these different influences, it's exchanged for a different traumatizing pressure. But, you know, it's almost sharpening in a way where, like, you gather all of your resources in which to, like, resist and survive. And something Armand used to say which was really interesting, both inside and out. He kind of had this phase of like, there was essentially Will, who I don't think we've ever had on the show, and maybe we'll make a good person to bring back in talking about addiction, which obviously at this point we need a whole nother episode for. But, you know, Will was Armand's mentor inside and out. And, you know, Armand, the way he tells the story, and we have an interview with Will on record where, you know, he would see Will like reading books and stuff while all the other guys are gambling and doing whatever. And so he gravitated towards that. And Will was just like, look, man, like, I'm on my own journey. I'm doing my thing. Like, I can't get caught up in all this. And Armand took that on. He was like, yeah, I don't need all this crazy stuff. Like, I need to get out of here and get straight and be good for my family and get work and do all these things. He was just full of aspiration. And I mean, this is where, I mean, you know, whether it's me or Tin Can Phone or whatever, I mean, I hope for people who are straight and have no prison and no issues that they can hear that they can insert themselves into this challenging context and have value. Because the things I hope, like, it's like prison's not the one. It is clearly not working if the guys are getting out and then dying. And so we need a different system entirely.
Yes.
But, you know, there's also ways in which part of this conversation is a citizen organized effort has proved fruitful and balancing for at least the hosts of the show, if not, and, you know, various of us are in touch with guests who have been on the show and how validating being on the show was for them. You got something, Quiz?
I'm just like, I felt like you were saying as if we was giving credit to the prison itself with the statement.
No, that I don't. I'm specifying that for the listener.
Yeah, and just for the listeners too, what I mean by that, for me especially, I go back to prison when I start slipping in out here. So prison at its best, my mental state was at its best because I was learning everything. I had no time for nothing else but learning, educating myself. And I know where I was at that place. So when I start slipping out here, mind you, it's a little different because it's not drugs involved. Drugs play a heavy part. Prison did not do anything for me, for real. You feel me? Except create the, put me in the space that allowed me to meet the people that I met. That's what prison did. But as far as the journey, yeah, we did that on our own. I don't want to just sit there and act like going to prison is the key for people. But some people, because they drug free and they're clear, and reputation is what people battle the most. Reputation. So when you go in there and you build that reputation, that's what people, you know. And but yeah, I just wanted to clarify, like, yeah, I'm not, it's not the prison. It's just the people are more willing to put the work in. When you sit in that cell all day, are you sitting on that bunk? You're going to start working on yourself. You're going to start seeing flaws in yourself. You're going to start. But then that's not to say that you're going to come home and be that person also. So that is a true statement. That is a real statement. But yeah.
Yeah. And that's something I wanted to pick up, you know, what you said outside, but also made me think of something I've been thinking of, because Reiko Hillier, professor over at Lewis and Clark, she does a class inside CRCI, recently did a really amazing production. And, you know, the thing is, it's like prison, it's embarrassing to me. Like, cars are more different than prison is 100 years ago. You know what I mean? Like, prison is almost the same thing as it was 100, 200 years ago. And so that is like, I'm just like, obviously that doesn't work. So there's that. But what Quiz was saying about people getting out and then holding on to that persona, I think that is, yeah, part of the major issue is it forges this way of being into one. I mean, similar to what we haven't gone into it much, but trauma, it reprograms the brain, like it changes your brain chemistry, and so does drugs. And, you know, between these things, but, you know, just the experience of being in prison is so challenging and traumatizing that when people get out, they can't readjust for several different reasons. And so, yeah, it just becomes a really insurmountable challenge. And, you know, again, I really hope that we can continue to make that more clear and hopefully, you know, develop new programs that are better than the options that exist. So, yeah, I guess the other thing I was going to say, you know, I was talking about being at the memorial, and I don't know exactly what I was going to say when I was bringing it up before, but something that's coming up for me is, man, I've been telling, it's like a part of my life, right? Like, it's not just even a friend, but, you know, a collaborator of this project that continues to live and I continue to do work with. And so just in casual conversation, I'll be like, oh yeah, my friend and collaborator passed away. And people will just, they'll do that immediate thing, like, oh, I'm sorry. And, you know, I mean, I appreciate the human inclination to, like, want to offer support. And I'm also really, it doesn't fulfill my deeper need, which I don't know if that's, like, fulfillable in a more broad spectrum way, just to say that I think society and the human culture is going to move how it moves. I don't know that those tectonic plates will shift in my lifetime. But, I mean, this is sort of a segue, but even a student of mine who had a loss, her project in my socially engaged art class was to create a sticker that says, like, talk to me about your recently departed loved one. Because she was feeling like there's not a place to, like, talk about it. It's like this kind of regurgitation of, like, expectation. Like, oh, I'm sorry. But the thing that's really interesting is twofold. One, I don't know that I'm not broken up about it, but I do. I mean, I was talking about this with Buddy when we first learned of his passing. Is at this point, it's another notch in my bedpost. You know what I mean? Like, I don't think this is the end of the people we're going to lose while we're doing this work. And I don't know that I'm, like, disassociated. I think maybe I have some security knowing that he'll actually be more alive in my work continually than a different context where it's just over and gone. But yeah, it's really staggering both to know that this is still happening. I mean, that's kind of like what I was feeling when I was, like, in, like, with the family and with the friends, and it was, like, affecting that group, like, very intensely. It was very untimely, very surprising. A young person with so much brilliance ahead of them. And, you know, I'm standing there, like, feeling my feeling for Armand. And then also, like, this issue persists. And so when people are like, oh, I'm sorry, it's this bypassing of that. The issue persists. Mm-hmm. Like, it's, oh, I'm sorry forever, because it's never going to stop if we don't really rally around it. So anyway, I just wanted to contribute that. And I know we're close to time. So if anyone want to give their final farewells on this very special Armand-centric episode, knowing that we're going to revisit addiction, dig into that more deeply in the future, maybe Blue Buddy and Queezle. Yeah.
I just want to share, you know, the addiction piece is a killer. It can kill the person that you know without them dying, or it can kill them all the way. And have a friend who his family did an intervention in the past couple months and saved his life, right? I think that with these things, and especially, you know, maybe the Portland context is definitely not unique, but it's out there on the streets, you know, people dying every week. And, where they say it's a good batch, right? It's a good batch, and that's the one that's going to kill you. And so I guess I would just say it can feel like there's no way to combat it. It can feel like there's no power to make a change, just like it sometimes feels that way with the prison system. And that's why we talk about it, to try to raise awareness about real issues affecting guys on the inside, but also guys once they get out, men and women. But if you have somebody that you know, or if you see people on the street and you know that people are dying in that week, talk to them, let them know there's a bad batch. If it's somebody you love, try to do the thing, try to help them. And I know it's hard. Like, I have friends that I've had to just be like, we can't be in relationship anymore. Like, it's not unhealthy. It's unsafe. And that's not where I want to be. But I guess that's kind of a two-sided message, but I guess it's my aspiration and also a little bit of my reality.
Yeah, it's a really hard thing to approach, especially with loved ones, because they look to you, because they trust you. But in the end, that's part of being a trustworthy friend. One thing that has been sitting in my mind throughout this episode is, and Armand, I mean, you know, generally like to talk and said a lot of pretty profound things, but one quote that always is the first that comes to my mind when I think about him, is Albina to China. Armand had a really deep love for Portland. And that was one of the first things that he said to me when I really started to get to know him. He's like, this is my city. You know, I grew up here and I know the people. And he was the kind of person that would converse, would want to, on a human level, get to know just about anyone. So I think in the larger context of this work, You know, Mike at one point described, you know, the prison system as an active war front. Well, especially when it comes to addiction, especially when we have shifting legislation regarding 110 and a new form of government in Portland. Portland is the battle zone. We see it on the streets. It's very apparent now. And like it or not, things will be changing. And it falls ultimately on, you know, us, on voters, on family members and friends to, you know, control the outcome, both in our own lives and in those of, you know, our fellow like Portlanders, Oregonians, and I guess country people. So yeah, that's just that's one thing. When I think of Armand, I think of Portland, I think of Rose City, and I always will, for sure. He had a lot of love for any and everyone that touched the city, and yeah, that's just that's my closer.
I just want to say something before Queez dials us out. I was talking to a friend of mine who works for a suicide hotline, and I was asking him about it, and he's like, do you need something? I'm like, no, I'm good. But, you know, I just had this friend pass, and I realized how much this project needs to be a compendium of resources. So 988 is the national suicide hotline, which, you know, he describes it as a catch-all, and it can send you to a local suicide hotline. But I imagine if you are experiencing drug challenges or whatever, that there are people who are sitting there ready to listen. And it's almost fascinating that as a species, you know, one of the things I grapple with is we have like toy guns or we have candy cigarettes. Like, what is this stuff? Like, why is this happening? And it's similar. I mean, I remember when I was younger, like suicide ideology was just something I really just didn't understand. And it's more of a societal issue than it is a personal issue. And that's why we have suicide hotlines. And so that's when I say, like, man, I really want to generate resources. Like, we need programs and other stuff to support people because, you know, these issues exist. So if you know anyone or you see someone on the street, 988, national catch-all. So please save yourself, save a friend. Queez, what do you got?
Man, just, I thought about it when Buddy said it, man. It's Grandma's Kitchen, when we was interviewing Teresa Rayford, he said that he was like, she's a Portland local. She's from Alpine to China. he literally said that. So that was my boy, man. I could spend a whole nother episode just funny stories and shit like that. But it's serious out here. You know what I'm saying? If you listening to this, man, you follow us, you know. Man, it's serious out here, man. I really don't even, if you ain't woke up by now, you ain't really, you know, onto it, to what's going on in the war at hand. Like, it's serious out here. People, like, it's really, we losing a lot of people to drugs. We losing a lot of people to suicide. It's a different world we live in. Ever since Corona was over the first time, ever since they let us back out, it has been a different world out here. You can't expect people to be who they was. I've witnessed people who lost themselves mentally just having to stay in the house for however long we was in the house for. Like, people sometimes cannot do solitary. So don't think because they once was this or that strong, or we go through things internally all the time. Some of the strongest people we know, sometimes it's hard for them to be strong. And shouts out Rob Richardson one more time. He always told me, sometimes the most important thing you can loan a friend is an ear. You don't gotta always have a problem. You don't gotta always try to find their solution. Just be somebody they could talk to. Just be willing to listen. Listen for real. Don't listen to wait for your turn. Misfit. Tin Can Phone.
You're listening to the Tin Can Phone podcast here at KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. Listen every single first Tuesday of every month at 10 a.m. or you can stream this at kboo.fm/tincanphone. Tune in at kboo.fm or 90.7 FM for more show.
You are tuned into KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Here goes nothing.
Tune in to KBOO for Drinking from Puddles, hosted by Brandon, every other Wednesday from 8 to 10 p.m. That's Drinking for Puddles, every other Wednesday from 8 to 10 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Yeah.
Tune in to Locus Focus, a weekly conversation about our place on the planet, every Monday morning at 10 on KBOO Community.